mind. No, don't call them names because they will lash back. Don't stoop to their level because I'm not stooping to their level. I'm killing it with kindness, man. That's the only thing we can do. Kill it with kindness, and that's all I have to say.
Tell someone that things will be just fine. I don't believe in myself. I can't lie. There's been times I wish that I was someone else. All anybody wants to do is love someone. All anybody really needs is to be loved. All of you, 'cause we all want a life that's full of joy. I'm telling you from a loving place, the joy is something that we choose. I'm feeling strong with every single word I say, 'cause we don't belong here in this cold, dark place. Will be fine if I don't believe in myself. I can't lie. If there's been times I wish that I was someone else. All anybody wants to do is love someone. All anybody really needs is to be loved. Nothing will stand.
You're muted, Kelly.
I'm unmuted. So hi, everybody, and welcome to this evening's special event. So I'm very happy to be here, of course, with, you know, my partner in all crimes, my big brother, Vlad. And so I'm so excited for tonight. We've got a lot of interesting information for everybody out there. Some actionable instructions for the rest of this country. It's time for us to start refocusing this entire movement towards an actual solution, as we've all been very busy across this entire country, working our butts off, building up public pressure and public support. But these things don't mean as much as they should if they're not backed with a long-term, long-lasting, permanent solution. So I'm very excited for tonight, and I'll let Vlad take it from here, and he'll let you know who's coming into this wonderful interview.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Welcome, everybody. Vladislav Sobolev. It was great to see a video with Robin there, a musical video. That was actually in Hamilton. That was one of the first chapters we started last year when we expanded Hugs Over Masks across Canada, North America, and then even some countries around the world picked up the movement. It was based on just bringing a community of people like-minded families together with kids. They can play in a park. And that's kind of been our mission statement since day one, is to empower people with right information to combat the brainwashing of the government and the media, and making sure that we can protect our rights and freedoms in this country. Canada is a beautiful place to be. Myself, I immigrated here for freedom and opportunity. And guess what? Today is our opportunity to defend that. And that's how I think we should all look at this. So today we have a tremendous guest with us, two doctors who are courageous, willingness to take risks and get uncomfortable and question what's really been going on, especially in the last year and a half and even before. But, you know, we've seen a tremendous spotlight on this whole big pharma establishment that's been corrupted well overboard long before this. But again, recent events really helped us to expose a lot of hypocrisies and blatant criminal activities. So today we are with great pleasure and privilege we have Dr. Daniel Negassi and Dr. Robert Malone, again, two very courageous men that lead in charge, helping doctors to stay relevant in today's censorship and propaganda. And I often say the reason why these doctors and other professional people get censored is not necessarily for us regular so-called people. They get censored so other people in the same establishment don't get to see the real truth, because then people are actually going to be waking up in huge numbers, and the whole system going to be collapsing. Because when you see your colleagues, people with profession, with degrees, talking the same language, you know, sounding alarms and saying that there should be freedom of choice, there should be risks being addressed. Especially nowadays when you see tremendous, you know, effects happening, including death, and then they get censored, they get silenced. And that's something that very familiar for me, being brought up in the Soviet Union. I'm very familiar with censorship and totalitarian regime and propaganda machine, how effective it is to brainwash people, unfortunately. So it's great to be here with these two doctors, and we have several other guests as well who we're going to bring in a moment. But just definitely want to extend my personal gratitude to you both. For all the work that you've done already, and I know a lot of work ahead of us, so we're definitely here to work together to make sure that we can protect humanity, not just in Canada or United States, but ultimately around the world. So thank you both for you, what you've done so far.
Yeah. So hello, Dr. Malone. Hello, Dr. Negassi. So thank you, guys. You guys can unmute if you like, and if you don't mind just giving a brief introduction of yourselves and where you're from, of course. And we'll start with Dr. Negassi, I guess.
Oh, hi, I'm Dr. Daniel Negassi. I'm an emergency doctor, and I was working in rural Alberta, all over rural Alberta, until September 12th of this year. I gave ivermectin to three patients on September 11th, and by September 12th, I was removed from my emergency room duties, and I had all the work that I had scheduled for the rest of the year cancelled by Alberta Health Services. So subsequent to that, I'm also under investigation by Alberta, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta, for having given ivermectin. And just recently, I'm subject to a complaint by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of BC. And the the only work I've done in BC is write vaccine exemption letters for a few nurses who have contacted me, trying to get out from under the vaccine mandate that's been pushed upon all the healthcare workers in both BC and Alberta.
Perfect, thank you. Dr. Malone?
Hi, I'm Robert Malone. I'm a physician scientist licensed to practice in the state of Maryland in the United States. I live in Virginia. I have a 30-year history as a vaccine developer and innovator. I work closely with the government. I've won or managed over $8 billion in grants and contracts. I have deep expertise in clinical development and regulatory affairs and everything having to do with both the discovery phase of vaccine technologies and new vaccine products, as well as what we call the advanced development phase. So that's the part that carries you from completing the animal studies through to licensure. So that's what I do. I've been involved in multiple outbreaks in the past. I was at the tip of the spear in pushing forward the PHAC ZBOV vaccine that we now call the Merck Ebola vaccine on behalf of the U.S. Department of Defense and my client that had purchased the vaccine from Public Health Canada. I was alerted by a CIA officer who was in Wuhan on January 4th of 2020 that I needed to get my team spun up and start focusing on building countermeasures for this virus, and I've been at it ever since. I am COVID recovered. I was infected in late February when I was in Boston for a computational drug discovery program. Yes, I am the guy that invented the mRNA technology back in the late 80s when I was a graduate student, as well as DNA vaccines and mucosal polynucleotide vaccines. And my wife and I were very involved in the initial incorporation of Inovio, and that technology is built off of our laboratory findings, et cetera. Enough about me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Malone. There's a few other people that are joining us on the show, along with my Toronto sidekick. Everybody likes to call her. I like to call her another partner in crime. Miss Rena Malka, and we also have, just give me one second, Rena. We also have Ted Kuntz, if we can pull Teddy up. We've got Ted Kuntz, who is the president of Vaccine Choice Canada with us. And we also have Sherry Strong from the Children's Health Defense. She's the Western representative that represents Robert Kennedy's organization. And everybody's gonna have their turns to come around the round table. We want to open with some questions, and Lena is she's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. Rena, do you want to introduce yourself, and then maybe we could start with some questions. And I'd like to give also Teddy and Sherry their fair share of time as well. Vlad and I are going to sit in the background and let you guys open discussion, and we'll probably butt in once in a while. So excuse our little butting, but if there's anything to add, we'll join in. Go ahead, Rena.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Ma'am. Hi, so my name is Rena Malka, and I'm the founder of Freedom Lovers Canada out of Toronto, and we help people with notices of liability. We have a Zoom call also on Tuesday nights. There's one tonight at 8:30 p.m. till 10 p.m. with various speakers to educate people, and we've just created a new nonprofit corporation, which will be raising funds to donate to various freedom causes. And we'll be keeping you updated, I'm sure, through Kellyanne. And later on, we could post the link if you'd like to join the other Zoom call when this one is done. And I'm so pleased to be here this evening and hear these great doctors speak. And thanks for organizing it, Kellyanne.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Sherry, did you want to come on quick? And Teddy, everybody in the country knows who you are, and that's why I'm saving you for last, honey.
So I'm the Alberta Provincial Director for Children's Health Defense Canada, and I belong to Life Force Canada. I'm the Health and Wellness Director. We're developing an alternative healthcare system, a true healthcare system. So our passion is protecting the kids right now, which the 5 to 11-year-olds are being approved, and we're terrified as to the impact that's going to have on humanity.
Thank you so much, Sherry. And of course, everybody, Mr. Ted Kuntz, he is the president of Vaccine Choice. Take it away, Teddy.
Well, Kellyanne, first of all, I want to say thanks for inviting me, and I haven't been called Teddy for about 60 years, so it's... it feels a little odd to be called Teddy. So, I'm with Vaccine Choice Canada. We have been in this movement for 40 years next year, advocating for the right to informed consent. I think what we've seen happen in the last 2 years is an incredible violation of our bodily sovereignty, our right to make medical decisions, and the right of parents to make medical decisions for their children. What I appreciate, I'm really looking forward to hearing Dr. Malone. The conversation has shifted, particularly in the last few weeks, it seemed, from talking about science and data and constitutional rights to criminality. And I think we're really in a different conversation, that what's happening, what we're witnessing, the violations of government and public health and mainstream media is criminal. And I'm glad we're finally calling it that.
It's wonderful. So, everybody, I would like to start drawing the attention to the amazing work of all the doctors that have signed on to this declaration. This declaration of crimes against humanity from the United States. That Dr. Robert Malone, I is it fair to say that you are leading the declaration, Dr. Malone?
Yeah, I'm president of the organization of physicians and scientists that sponsor that the Declaration One, and we now have a Declaration Two out.
Which is absolutely wonderful. Derek, do we have that video clip? Did you receive it?
Yeah, I did.
So
you want me to play that?
Yes, please. If it's just so all the new viewers out there, because I know that this is being shared on probably 100 platforms or so right now, and there's a lot of physicians watching. I think it's very important for those who might have been oppressed from this information, for them to learn about what is actually happening. So please do roll the clip.
Welcome to our national call with Vaccine Choice Canada. My name is Ted Kuntz, and I'm the president of Vaccine Choice Canada. We have an incredible turnout this evening. We realized earlier today that we needed to change our plan with Zoom to increase our capacity so that everyone who registered would be able to join this call. Without an increase, hundreds of you would have been left in the waiting room. What a lovely problem to have, but while I'm delighted to see all of you, it doesn't escape me that we are here in these numbers because of the sad state of Canada today and the world, and the increasingly egregious violations of our rights and freedoms by our various governments. That said, a special welcome to those of you joining us for the first time. I hope you value what you see and hear and will want to join us every Wednesday for these important conversations. Much of this increase, I suspect, tonight is due to Randy Hillier. Randy is with us tonight and is live streaming this conversation. Randy, I'm sure you can hear me. Thank you for joining us and for all your good work in standing up for our rights and freedoms in Canada. And now for our special guest. We are privileged to have a very knowledgeable and respected guest this evening. I trust Dr. David Martin is known to all of you. He is an incredibly intelligent and articulate man in the bow tie whose testimony in plandemic shocked the world. David revealed with undeniable evidence that the COVID pandemic has been planned for decades. I assume that most of you are well acquainted with this information, and so we intend to use our time with David tonight to advance the conversation and expose even more information that proves that the events of today are the results of planning of yesterday. Welcome, Dr. Martin, and thank you for joining us this evening.
It is an honor to have this moment to bridge what has historically, since 1815, been the longest unguarded and open fellowship of countries, and to will that some part of this conversation will once again make permeable that which has been rendered by those who choose to suppress humanity impermeable at the moment. And we're looking forward to the day, whether it's at the Calgary Stampede or sipping wine at the CN Tower in Toronto, or watching the beautiful nature phenomenon up in Nova Scotia, or doing what I love to do, which is kayaking around British Columbia. When we can do that face-to-face and hand-in-hand, I will be delighted that we had this conversation so that we can reopen what should never be closed.
Wow, beautiful words to start off with, David. Thank you. I'm assuming.
Derek, sorry, can you cut the video? I think you played the wrong. This was the wrong clip. So, sorry, guys. We've been so. Derek, sorry. Can you take that down? So we've been so busy, all of us, that we might be just a tad unorganized tonight.
But I appreciate the free advertising, though. Thank you.
Yes. So, but there is a. Did you receive the declaration, Derek? So,
not yet. No.
No, it's okay. So I'm going to let Dr. Malone and maybe do you want to describe the declaration to the viewers just while I send the clip to Derek? Well, the clip is 5 minutes, so I don't think we should play the whole thing. I think it might be better if Dr. Malone just describes to our viewers exactly what the declaration is and what we intend to achieve with it.
So the original declaration one that was read in the COVID summit of Rome. So that was the International COVID Summit that was organized by Canadians, by the way. That declaration was designed to make the clear and unambiguous statement about physicians' right to practice medicine. And it relates to, as you know, and you've seen in Canada, and your other guest here is a case study in this, we've had physicians hunted by the press and slandered in the media and actively repressed for merely the crime of trying to save their patients' lives by keeping them out of the hospital and administering life-saving treatments. And the world has chosen for various reasons to focus on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, but there are many other agents, including the ones that we have about to go into clinical trials. Under sponsorship of the U.S. Department of Defense, which is high-dose famotidine and celecoxib. Another agent is aspirin, by the way. So there's a wide variety of agents that can keep people out of the hospital. And so we developed as a community, this is the International Alliance of Physicians and Scientists, we developed a statement, Declaration of Rights, for physicians to practice medicine. This was the first declaration, and this is part of a very carefully considered strategy and tactic set of responses to the censorship and propaganda and, frankly, full-out media warfare that we're in the middle of right now. The physicians' declaration of Rome was used as a platform to solicit individuals, and I'm sorry to those who aren't physicians and scientists, but it was a conscious attempt to allow us to stake out a position that would counter the media narrative that we were all a bunch of right-wing crazies and a small number of right-wing crazies at that. And so rather than the Great Barrington Declaration, we elected that our declaration would just be signed off by medical scientists and physicians. We received over 13,000 and still climbing signatures endorsing it from all over the world, which, by the way, is more physicians and scientists that work for the entire Health and Human Services branch of the U.S. federal government. So that's CDC, FDA, and NIH, among others. So with this success, and as a next step in the strategy that you can see being deployed on the website, www.globalcovidsummit.org, what we have there is highly curated information. It's designed to be physicians talking to other physicians and medical professionals. You're all very welcome to participate and review the information there. But again, it's not intended as much to be for a lay audience, but rather to provide clear, unambiguous information for other professionals and in part to address a lot of the criticisms that are being thrown at us by the press and by really backed by the pharmaceutical industry. Since then, we've now put out Declaration Number 2. Declaration Number 2 builds upon that, incorporates it. But in Declaration Number 2, we have three key principles. So we've distilled our media messaging down to three main points, each of which are backed by many, many peer-reviewed references. Number one, the risk-benefit ratio and the logic justification for vaccinating children with these SARS-CoV-2 vaccines is absolutely unacceptable. There is no reason for vaccinating children against SARS-CoV-2 with any of these genetic vaccines. They don't get the disease unless they already have significant comorbidities, so pre-existing disease. And they are at risk from these jabs. So there's just no rationale for vaccinating the children. Point number two, we believe strongly that physicians should be allowed to practice medicine and should be allowed to administer life-saving medications to their patients. So that's a key point. Point number three, okay, I'll put the link up in a minute. I'm seeing the chat on the side. Point number three is that the data are quite clear. There's well over 100 papers, peer-reviewed papers now. Natural immunity is superior to vaccine-induced immunity. And furthermore, vaccination on top of natural immunity confers added risks over and above the risks of vaccination of the naive. There's no reason to vaccinate those that have natural immunity. It is superior in terms of protection, durability, and breadth. And the people who have natural immunity should not be constrained in any way from going about their business, participating in public life, shopping at the grocery store, and all of the other absurd things that have been imposed on these people. And I'm sorry to say that I think you guys are second only to the Australians in terms of the pressures that you've been put under by your government. New Zealand, I guess, is being another example of what I think many of us assumed was a very civilized nation that has just gone straight down the toilet bowl in terms of authoritarianism. So that's a nutshell for the Declaration Number 2. And this is part of a larger integrated effort that is very much backed by media savvy people. This is what we're doing is designed to take on the media memes and messages. And we're now cooperating with FLCCC. This is Pierre Corey's group. Pierre's a good friend. And you'll see more of that integration as time goes by. There's a big press push going on right now. And we're increasingly integrating with a group that you haven't heard of yet, but you will soon, called the Unity Project, which is funded by some high net worth individuals that are really pretty incensed over Governor Newsom and what's happening in California. So that's the short version. I hope I wasn't too long-winded.
No, that was wonderful. Okay. That was wonderful. I'd like to bring, can we bring Dr. Nagase up on the screen as well? So I'd like to introduce you two gentlemen properly right now. And what I would like to ask Dr. Malone is how can I help, and how can Dr. Nagase help bring the same sort of declaration upon the Canadian government? Because I'll tell you right now, as far as it goes with Daniel, I will do anything to protect this man and to forward his work and to protect his license and provide him with the public pressure required to protect that license. And I'm sure that everybody on this call will back me up on that. So so if we could just allow the doctors to have a little bit of a discussion, and maybe Ted, let Ted come in on it as well, because I'm sure that Ted and Sherry both have some very valid questions, and then myself and Rena and Vlad will follow up as well.
So hello, sounds Dr. good. Nagase.
Hello, Dr. Malone.
I my heart goes out to you, and I've had many colleagues that have been in your position. Of course, Peter McCullough is among the highest profile. But I don't know if there's misery loves company. Your experience is absolutely not unique, although it is the most prompt action I've ever heard of. You said three patients total triggered this, and then a few letters to some nurses for medical exemptions in another province. What you've experienced has been repeated throughout the world. There are very, very few physicians that have actually lost their license, by the way, as you probably know. And what I've observed is that there's this coordinated strategy that, and who knows who's backing this, but I have my suspicions. But this coupled activity of individuals, someone filing complaints with a medical board, which is something that most medical boards, certainly in the States, are obligated to investigate. And so this is an easy way to weaponize that process, is that anybody that hears that there's a physician that is in the current environment is administering early treatment or life-saving medication outside of the hospital can be subjected to harassing complaints to the medical board, and then the medical board will be forced to investigate those complaints. The only physicians that I've heard of that, yes, of course, it's for the psychological effect. I'm just seeing the chat box go, scroll with new comments. Of course, it's for psychological effect. And it's coupled not only, so first you get the letters submitted to the medical board. And then you get the press attacks that say this physician is now under investigation by their medical board, which all sounds very ominous. And it's used to destroy your practice, your ability to practice medicine, your ability to participate in any of the various medical groups that normally you would have to participate in. If you want hospital privileges, et cetera. Usually under this withering attack from the press, physicians lose their admission rights to various hospitals. And by the way, this is the same strategy occurs here, occurs in Europe, occurs in Portugal, occurs in Latin America, occurs in the United States. It's the same set of steps. Now, there's two physicians that I've heard of that have lost their license. Both of them committed the dire sin of not wearing masks and ostensibly putting their patients at risk by of their life and health by the physicians not wearing the masks. The physicians weren't infected. They weren't shedding virus. And we all know that the masks have poor efficacy, but this has been considered to be sufficient to terminate their license to practice medicine after 12 plus years of higher education to get to that point. So what you're experiencing is this same trajectory. Now, this is part of the reason why we went to Maui as a group, Ryan Cole and Richard Urso and myself and others. And we took on the case of three physicians on Maui that had been attacked using this same strategy. And one of the things that was done before we ever landed was that surveys were set up on Maui concerning these three physicians, two of them in particular. And then I pushed that out through Twitter and internationalized it so that suddenly there was this onslaught of international attention of what had been happening to these three physicians. The physicians in question included Lauren Pang, who is a MD, MPH, former Walter Reed Army research specialist in medical ethics, very, very strong proponent of the importance of informed consent, and a fourth generation resident of Maui. This means a lot on the islands, as well as having been the public health officer for Maui for 20 years, an eminently qualified individual. another individual that was branded in this way because of administering early treatment was a pediatric cardiologist who's also a pastor of a fairly large local congregation. He was run out of his hospital for administering early treatment and keeping people out of the hospital. He and his wife were basically both excommunicated from the medical community, and they have set up their own clinics and are doing quite well. So we brought international attention to this, embarrassed the local press, embarrassed the local politicians that had been running this scam. The lead one actually has received historically money from both Monsanto and from Pfizer. And so by outing these people, we were able to embarrass them. And in the end, in particular, the MDMPH received personal apologies from major politicians in Hawaii for having been subjected to this. So my message to you is stand tall. You're in good company. I can't imagine better company than Peter McCullough. Unfortunately, he has had to spend over $100,000 in legal fights because he's being attacked by a shadow organization that is pushing Baylor to attack him. But this is the strategy that they're deploying all over the world. And I'm sorry to say you're being a victim of it. But I can tell you that in the case of Maui and the politics there and Lauren Pang, that a good dose of sunlight and embarrassment had a huge effect. So for this community, I know you're a bunch of activists, bless your hearts. And I'm really grateful to hear you standing up for a physician like this. And I can tell you that those that have been subjected to this, it is just heart-wrenching. You spend your whole life trying to serve people and help people, and then you're subjected to this kind of garbage. So having people and having your community support him, I think is going to be super important, not only for success, but also for his general mental health. So there's my comment. Over.
Over. Well, I have to clue in quickly. So I'm not just an activist. I am a clinical psychologist. I do have a master's in political science, a master's in social engineering. I've studied human behavior. I've studied culture, society, ancient civilizations, and traveled the entire world diving right into culture. And I just have a love for people. So when I came home, rather than getting into politics on that level, I decided on music because I felt that it was the best way to bring people together. And then Justin Trudeau got elected, and I could not ignore it. And now here we are. But at the beginning of this round of activism, Derek, if you're almost ready, I'd like to pull up that link. There's also another thing about me that most people don't realize. And I have O negative Rh null blood, which is a very rare blood type for those of you out there who don't know it. If you Google me, it's comedy. It'll tell you I'm either the blood of Christ or some sort of an alien. However, on closer inspection, I create 10,000 times more white blood cells than the average person. So my body and my immune system tends to fight off viruses way stronger than the average person. So when we began in this round, I was actually at Sunnybrook Hospital with the scientific team that were collecting the several different pathogens from several different patients. And I had provided them with 19 vials of my blood over a period of 22 days for which that they could use to test against all these different pathogens in order to try to utilize something, I guess, to form some sort of synthetic antibody. If you could scroll down, the PDF should be somewhere on that link. If you scroll the way down, we have the original repository report, which was given to me by these scientists. And I'm not sure if any of you doctors, if either of you doctors, or even if you, Ted, have ever had a copy of this report. If you could scroll down to lines 210 to 216, for me, please. On April 12th, 2020, this repository report was submitted to the Canadian government. In this report, on lines 210 to 216, it clearly states that the government was fully aware and informed that asymptomatic people were neither capable of, neither threatened by nor capable of spreading this virus, which means that the very first lockdown was a violation of Section 83 of the Criminal Code of Canada, an act of domestic terrorism in our economy. So I'm not sure if you gentlemen have ever seen this original repository report, but it is available publicly and has been for over a year. Now, the other thing I wanted to address on this link, as you guys can see, I don't know if you doctors want to clue in on the language. Maybe have a peek and tell me what you think. So I don't know if you've seen this, but I can supply both of you with this as well. Maybe it can help. Maybe it won't. I'm not sure. Go ahead, Dr. Nagas.
So this one, it looks like they needed to propagate the virus in Vero cells. So I wonder what they used to get the virus to get into the Vero cells, what type of electroporation or microwave poration techniques they used just to get the virus into the cells. I mean, cells in general don't like to have foreign genetic material inserted into them. So, you know, there's so much to, like, if you want me to get into molecular biology and cell biology, I'd love to.
I think that would be a whole different show.
But, you know, like, getting back to what Dr. Malone was talking about, what I thought was so flabbergasting is how completely fact resistant the Alberta Health Services executive were. And then, you know, I kind of got the whole factual portion of my activism or work out within the first week that they removed me from all my shifts. And then, you know, within a week of me giving ivermectin, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta banned the use of ivermectin. I mean, this is completely unprecedented. And then a few days later, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of British Columbia also banned the use of ivermectin. But the interesting thing is, in both of those statements where they're banning the use of ivermectin, they also push very hard the use of the mRNA vaccines as the only preventative treatment and prophylactic against COVID-19. And again, this is even though the data in Alberta clearly showed that there was a fourth wave well after over 70% of Albertans were vaccinated. And the fourth wave was almost as large as the third wave, which was largely before the vaccination. So clearly, if you took the province of Alberta as a test subject, the 80%, 70% vaccination threshold had absolutely no effect on the peak deaths in the third wave, which was before the vaccination, and fourth wave. And yet the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta made this ridiculous statement saying that vaccination remains the only prophylactic, the best treatment, and a whole bunch of other nonsense. So, I mean, I don't know who told me this, but there's no point in arguing with the dog. The dog just doesn't understand, right? So if you have an entire College of Physicians and Surgeons, an entire administration of Alberta Health Services, all composed of doctors, completely fact resistant, like you can show them the studies, you can show them the numbers, and denial, denial, denial. You know what? It's useless trying to even speak to these organizations. You're never going to get anywhere with them. They've dug, entrenched themselves in an opinion for whatever reason, and they're not changing their minds, which is completely unscientific. The whole point of science is to change your minds when the evidence shows you you're wrong, right? And so the essence of the philosophy of science is the humility to consider the possibility that you are wrong. Yes. That is the whole point of science. If you don't entertain the possibility that you're wrong, you're not a scientist. You're not even a doctor. Nope. Right? Always in the back of my head, because I'm always working emergency, I always keep in the back of my head this possibility, am I missing something? Am I wrong about something? Right? Because then that keeps your mind open to seeing the clue, making the observation that says, oh, this is not this particular illness, it's a completely different illness. So for some reason, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta and BC, they are completely fact resistant. which leads me to think that they are completely driven by dogma or an ulterior motive.
Yep.
So instead of wasting my time trying to convince these people who are impossible to, you know, it's impossible to open their eyes to reality, I've been spending my time recently trying to explain molecular biology and cell biology to in this over this particular weekend was the province of PEI, Prince Edward Island. And Prince Edward Island is a very small province. It's the smallest province in Canada. And they have kind of an insular, they're a very small community. So when word gets out in one group within Prince Edward Island, it spreads across the entire province like wildfire. So I had a quick last minute emergency podcast type meeting with a few people who were very well known in Prince Edward Island, just talking about the theoretical cancer risk from mRNA injections given to children. And, you know, the three points I went through was, well, there's endogenous reverse transcriptase, and this has been known since the 1990s, and it seems to be more active in embryogenesis and development. So that means if children have reverse transcriptase active, anything that you inject into children that's mRNA can be converted into DNA. And once it's converted into DNA, if it happenstance goes into the nucleus, then there's possibility for integration. You won't see the effects of that for decades after the child has got an mRNA injection. The second mechanism I was talking about, and this was just to try and explain to a lay audience, that when you have endogenous body cells producing foreign non-human proteins, such as spike proteins, if that immune system is still in development, as it is when you have a child's body still in development, that body might learn an immune tolerance to foreign non-human proteins being produced by the body's own cells. And that's a big problem when it comes to long-term cancer resistance, because one of the ways that the body detects cancerous cells is from abnormal proteins. So if a child's body has an immune system that learns that abnormal proteins like spike proteins are not something to be concerned about, then you have a possibility of developing cancer later in life because that immune system is not as sensitive to picking up foreign proteins. And then the third, you know, theoretical mechanism I was talking about was, well, what if the body is busy producing spike proteins and it's not producing normal complement of proteins for growth, and particularly proteins such as heat shock proteins when exposed to environmental stressors like toxins or radiation like from sunburn. So these heat shock proteins are DNA protection and repair proteins that every cell produces naturally in response to a metabolic stressor. So this morning I actually got an email from some user named Martin. I don't know Martin who, but he forwarded me this one article. And if I could share, just share my screen for a second here. Let's see. I wonder if it'll let me share. This was a molecular biology article from October. It was published October the 8th, 2021. Or sorry, October 13th, 2021. And it says SARS-CoV-2 spike impairs DNA damage repair and inhibits VDJ recombination in vitro. So I just found out literally this morning that it's been proven in cell cultures that not only does the spike protein, like production of the spike protein, impair the repair of damage in DNA, it also impairs directly the immune system. And I think, and I didn't know, this is less than a month old information, that my theoretical concerns regarding the cancer risk of mRNA injections has already been proven in cell culture as of last month. So for me, this should be front page news that the mRNA injections, especially spike protein mRNA injections, can directly inhibit the immune system. On top of preventing the regular DNA surveillance and repair that the body does naturally as a part of its daily activities. So, I mean, this.
So, Dr. Daniel, I got to wonder whether this is something that they didn't know and were just discovering it, or whether this is part of the plan.
you know, it's very suspicious, right? That the injection for mRNA, the spike protein out of all the proteins produced by the virus that were studied by this group, I think I'll just let you know what the author was, Hui Jiang, H-U-I-J-I-A-N-G, and then Yafeng Mei, Y-A-F-A-N-G-M-E-I, if people want to look up this study. It's from the Department of Molecular Biosciences at the Wenner-Gren Institute in Stockholm. So one of the things they went through is they tested on cell cultures the whole virus and various proteins from the virus that end up in the nucleus of the cells. And out of all the different proteins that a virus creates, the spike protein was the most inhibitory to DNA repair. Hmm. And that's absolutely mind-blowing. And what it made me think of is, well, should people be afraid of the SARS-CoV-2 virus as being a carcinogen on its own? But then you think about the mechanism. If you get, let's say, SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 in the epithelial cells of your nose, mouth, or your lungs, those cells are shed every 30 to 90 days. So if DNA damage is caused to the mucosal cells inside your nose, it actually doesn't matter, because 30 days later, you've got an entirely new set of cells in your nose and cells lining the epithelium of your lungs. So as long as the virus stays outside of the blood, then you're pretty much home free. No matter what kind of DNA damage the virus does, 30 days later, you've got an entirely new set of cells lining the inside of your lungs and the inside of your nose. So then the question arises, okay, so if SARS-CoV-2 gets into the blood and you have a systemic viremia, then yes, there is a theoretical risk that the SARS-CoV virus in and of itself, because it produces spike proteins, is carcinogenic. But you take it to the next level, what happens if you're injecting the mRNA in a nanoparticle? So basically infecting yourself with just the segment of DNA that produces the spike protein. This is even worse than getting a systemic SARS-CoV-2 viremia or viral infection in the blood, because all of a sudden you have these elements in the blood. It bypasses the cells that you shed every 30 to 90 days. It's in the blood. It has access to the cells in your body that live with you for the rest of your life, and it can directly cause DNA damage. This is unbelievable.
Well, and then beyond that is that we have a medical system and regulatory agencies that refuse to hear the information you just presented. Mm-hmm. So we're locked into a destructive cycle here of harming humanity.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think it's important what we talked about at the beginning of this show about that we really need to look at solutions and how important it is to look at solutions, because how do you solve a college of physicians and surgeons, health authorities that administer, you know, the health and the hospitals for an entire province. In British Columbia, there's 5 different health authorities, but basically these health authorities all administer the entirety of hospital care within a province. When these organizations and then the politicians and the health ministers are completely fact resistant, how as a society can you correct that?
And the media.
And the media are completely fact resistant. So that gets into a very deep philosophical problem.
I would say it's more than philosophical, it's existential.
The piece that I would really like to inject in right now is that no fascist government has ever come into power by following the law or the rules. And what we see is that it's the medical system, the political system, the school system, almost every single system seems to be colluding together to basically just block out any information, whether it's facts, that doesn't go according to the plan and the narrative that they have. So for me, the big thing in this sense of urgency around the children right now, with 5 and 11 year olds being lined up to be given these injections, is, aren't we better off to just start to develop these parallel services and pull children from the schools? Because I personally don't feel our children are safe in schools, not just from the injections, but the curriculum, the masking, and the abuse and the bullying, all that kind of thing. And I just think we're trying to fight Goliath. What about if we just go off and live in a village around Goliath rather than, you know, we develop our own system where Goliath is not a welcome. And because right now I just feel putting them into the schools, putting them into people, into hospitals, and trying to fight this legally and using the rules against people who are completely ignoring you seems to be a waste of resources and energy. I'd love your thoughts.
Myself, I agree completely. The solution has to be a complete divestment from even the judicial system here in Canada, because I had the opportunity to read one of the Justice Germain's judgment in the case of the whistle stop owner Chris Scott, and it is absolutely insane. There is no logic, there is no reason in this judge's judgment. He's quoting a doctor who can't tell the difference between intoxication and pneumonia as evidence why he is throwing down this extreme judgment of a contempt of court against Chris Scott. So if the judicial system is corrupted as well, and I guess, you know, unredeemably corrupted, then what choice do you have as a society? You have to build from the ground up, and society has to remove themselves from this completely, completely unjust, completely corrupted system. And we just have to say no. We're starting our own society, and the old corruption from the old society is not welcome in this new world that we're going to have to create for ourselves.
I agree.
Yeah, and I think it's already started. You know, there's Ezra Wellness, which is the nurses-run organization to provide alternative healthcare options for people. There's several homeschool pods and organization that sprung in the last year and a half. And obviously, you know, we're doing what we can to encourage businesses, restaurants, gym owners, etc., to you know, respect people's freedom of choice and body autonomy. So I think it's already started. I mean, it's one of the best ways to combat the tyranny is to create parallel society and to make sure that we expand that. Of course, we can do what we can to battle the Goliath, as you say, which I agree. And at the same time, we should spend almost equal time, if not more, developing this alternative universe within our world with our values. And I agree with Sherry, you know, children are not safe in schools for many reasons. And unfortunately, it's just part of what we need to expose, but ultimately build forward. I'm glad we have Dr. Malone back on. I don't have too much time, so please take the floor. I know you wanted to comment something on Dr. Nagasi earlier, so please go ahead, sir.
Well, it's long past. I don't want to disrupt your discussion. Perhaps we should reschedule, and I can participate in your community perhaps in some later week. Do be careful about overinterpreting retrovirology and reverse transcriptase, et cetera. The watchword I gently suggest is clinically significant. And I'm well familiar with the reverse transcriptase issues, but I'm not compelled. You know, there was, if I could leave you with one thing, we're under intense scrutiny and pressure from well-funded detractors, and we need, my general suggestion is we have to be super careful about our messaging and what we're stating. And I personally believe it's not useful to speculate about things like integration. Some of the phenomena that you were describing, Doctor, they will occur, for instance, the presence of exogenous RNA. This is what the virus does. This is what all RNA viruses do. And our genomes are not loaded up with, generation on generation of new viral integration. So I really think one does need to be a little cautious.